New U.S. President Joe Biden proposes a five-year extension with Russia of New START, the last remaining nuclear reduction treaty between the two countries. Iran's foreign minister warns new U.S. President Joe Biden of Israeli plots to push Washington into confrontation with the Islamic Republic. Also coming up, Iraqis hold a funeral for the victims of Thursday's deadly twin bomb attacks in the capital Baghdad, claimed by Daesh terrorists. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the United States says it seeks to extend the New START, its last remaining arms control treaty with Russia. New U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed to extend the 2020 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty for five more years, but he pledged to pressure Moscow on other fronts. Russia had earlier offered to extend the treaty by 5 years, but the former U.S. administration refused the proposal and offered a short-term extension, which was rejected by Moscow. The treaty, which limits the United States and Russia to 1,550 nuclear warheads each, expires on February the 5th. Political commentator Vladimir Golstin says both Russia and the United States, despite the rhetoric, would like to extend the New START treaty and avoid a potentially dangerous nuclear arms race.
Well, you know, it's just more or less a gesture of goodwill. It was expected. Many analysts on both sides understood that it's pretty beneficial for both countries. You know, nobody needs a very, intense arms race at that moment when economies or each country is not doing particularly well, and each country has a lot on their plate. So that's what's kind of so more or less logical. Trump administration decided to sort of reconsider that because, as Alison said, that they wanted to China to be involved, and China said we don't want to be involved because we have less. And there was other issues of verification, but it stood to reason. However, you know, that was like Trump's attitude of not respecting any treaties done before him. Now we have a new president, Biden, who doesn't want to respect the attitudes of Trump. So I think it makes sense. It made perfect sense.
The U.S. House of Representatives will reportedly send an impeachment charge accusing former President Donald Trump of inciting insurrection to the Senate as early as Friday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected Republican demands to back away from an impeachment trial. She emphasized that the House is ready to begin their trial, but did not say when she would send the impeachment article to the Senate. Democrats are narrowly in control of the Senate, but at least two-thirds of the 100-member body is required to convict Trump. If convicted, a separate vote will be taken whether to block the former president from seeking office again. Some Senate Republicans have argued that Congress should not put a former president on trial. And U.S. President Joe Biden has warned that the worst of the coronavirus pandemic is yet to come for the Americans.
Let me be very clear. Things are going to continue to get worse before they get better. The memorial we held two nights ago will not be our last one, unfortunately. The death toll will likely top 500,000 next month. The cases will continue to mount. We didn't get into this mess overnight, and it's going to take months for us to turn things around. Let me
be equally clear. On his first full day as president, Biden painted a bleak picture of the country's coronavirus battle, criticizing the former administration for the situation. He said the federal government had failed to act with the necessary urgency, focus, and coordination over the past year, inflicting a tragic cost. The president added that the rollout of vaccines has been a, quote, dismal failure so far. He noted that the pandemic has disproportionately impacted the Blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans. Biden signed a series of executive orders aimed at addressing the pandemic, which has already claimed more than 409,000 American lives and infected over 24.5 million people. As Joe Biden takes over the White House, many are asking what changes will be made to American foreign policy, in particular towards Yemen. Trump's terrorist designation of Yemen's Ansar Allah and continued U.S. support for the Saudi-led aggression have both hampered peace efforts.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former U.S. President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansar Allah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansar Allah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for, and you would see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new U.S. President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over, they stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop, and Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the U.S. ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansar Allah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's foreign minister warns new U.S. President Joe Biden of Israeli plots to push Washington into confrontation with the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the Israeli prime minister aimed to trap another U.S. president into spending American blood and treasure to confront Iran. Zarif also lambasted Benjamin Netanyahu's congratulatory message to Biden, in which he urged the newly sworn-in president to work with Israel to confront what he called the Iran threat. Zarif called the message boot-licking and cringe-worthy obsequiousness, stressing such desperate plotting against Iran will fail. Israel's call for an anti-Iranian stance follows Biden's remarks about a conditional return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Elsewhere, Iraqi people hold a funeral for the victims of a twin bomb attack in the capital, Baghdad. Mourners participated in a funeral procession while shouting religious chants. They carried the coffins of the victims towards a cemetery for burial. Two male bombers blew themselves up in a crowded market in Baghdad. The explosions killed at least 32 people and wounded over 110 others. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Political commentator Ali Neshmi says the Daesh terrorist group is making a resurgence in Iraq thanks to U.S.-Israeli efforts to weaken the country's popular mobilization units.
There is many injured, more than 100, and the martyrs is more than 30, and no one declared till now about who's behind it. But I think there is many wings or many directions behind that, and especially now the ISILs increasing their action in the Iraq, especially in this period when the government and the Western and American and Israel, they targeted the popular mobilization and the people now shouting against them, and they listen for this media against the popular mobilization, and there is a policy now from 6 months to reducing or to weakening popular mobilization. Then they used that kind of weakening, and they escaped and come in the central of Baghdad and using the explosive belt.
Welcome back. Now, turning to other news, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has urged the Nigerian president to release top Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Ezekzaki and his wife over their deteriorating health condition. The group made a call in a letter to Muhammad Buhari after the cleric's wife, Zinat, tested positive for COVID-19. The couple are currently imprisoned in Kaduna State Jail. The NGO also asked the United Nations to pressure the Nigerian government to immediately release Sheikh Ezekzaki and his wife. The two have been in jail since the Nigerian army attacked their residence in the northern city of Zaria. Hundreds of Sheikh Ezekzaki's supporters were killed in the raid, and many others were arrested. Despite a high court ruling, the cleric remains behind bars as part of a government crackdown on his Islamic movement of Nigeria. Political commentator Masoud Shajara says the imprisonment of Sheikh Ezekzaki and his wife is an outrageous act by Nigeria's government and is against international law.
The reality is that under the international law, and indeed Nigerian law, someone who is who's ill to the extent that the health condition of both of them, under the current pandemic, should be at least put somewhere safe. I mean, the fact that, you know, someone has actually is already been shown positive should be taken to hospital. We are not saying to you know, overlook the legal due process. What we are saying, the legal due process need to be implemented. And indeed, they should be now taken to a safe place, i.e. a medical facility, so they will be able to, to be able to get remedy. What seems to be very clearly, and I say this because I can't see any other excuses except that they really want to endanger their lives, and they want to actually, by dragging their feet, to sort of create the environment where both Sheikh and his wife are in danger of actually dying. And it seems that that is the only explanation, and that is really is outrageous.
Now, Israel's plan to build 2,500 new settler units in the occupied West Bank has drawn condemnations from the Muslim world. The Arab League slammed Israel for its disregard for international calls to end the construction of settlements. It's called on the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take measures to put a stop to the illegal activities. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation also denounced the move as the continuation of the regime's violation of international resolutions. It added that such decisions are made to undermine the outlook for a solution to the Palestinian issue. All Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law. Human rights activist Bruce Katz says the Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel have effectively endorsed the regime's expansionism.
Statements by the Arab League and the Islamic Organization of Cooperation should be taken with a grain of salt, because when you look at a number of the countries that are their members, and I refer to countries like Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, Oman, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. These are all countries that are have normalized with Israel, and therefore they support the apartheid state, and as such, they give a green light to exactly what is happening with the expansion of settlements being done with impunity. So from the point of view of Arab countries, of certain Arab countries that have continuously stabbed the Palestinians in the back, there's nothing much to be expected from them except words that float in the air and which are basically meant to keep their populations from being too critical. It's really just mere posturing.
Paris says it will not apologize for the atrocities committed by French forces in Algeria during the colonization of the North African country. President Emmanuel Macron says he will instead commemorate his country's colonial past in three ceremonies organized by the government.
French President Emmanuel Macron has rolled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that the French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Yes, scientists have worked to uncover the mysteries of water on the moon. Now two new studies published in Nature Astronomy confirm that water may be found all over the lunar surface. Stay with us for an article penned by Maya Y. Heiss, a science staff writer for National Geographic under the heading Water on Moon's Surface May Be More Abundant Than Once Thought. Stay with us for more of Maya Y. Heiss's article. One study reports the first unambiguous evidence for water molecules clinging to or encapsulated within grains in the lunar soil under sunlit swathes of the surface. The second study modeled small zones on the moon cast in permanent shadow and found that some 15,400 square miles, an area equivalent to nearly 7,500,000 football fields, are cold enough to harbor ice. About 20% more than once thought. By investigating what forms of water linger on the lunar surface and where that water is, scientists hope to better understand the moon's mysterious water cycle. Unlike on Earth, where water circulates in rivers and rain, the formation of water on the moon may be driven by hydrogen in the solar wind, reacting with oxygen on the surface, as well as by icy meteorites that strike the ground. Lunar water may also migrate from sunny regions to shadowy zones. But the exact movement of this water and possible transfer from sunny to shadowy zones remain mysterious. Jessica Sunshine, a planetary scientist at the University of Maryland, says, "We still have a lot to work to understand if, at all, they're connected. But the new research suggests a much more complex process than what we thought before. This work is also vital for future humans traveling to the moon and beyond, including NASA's upcoming Artemis mission that promises to place the first woman and the next man on the moon. The presence of water and ice hints it may be possible to mine this resource to convert to fuel, reducing the load future spacefarers must take in their ventures beyond Earth. The new insight into lunar water is part of a slow shift in the way we think of our planetary companion. Once thought to be a desiccated landscape, this dynamic world has complex sources and sinks of many forms of water. The moon is a world of extreme hot and cold. Daytime temperatures near the lunar equator can climb to a scorching 250 degrees Fahrenheit, whilst nighttime can plunge to a frosty minus 208 degrees Fahrenheit. And without a thick protective atmosphere, evaporated water can quickly escape to space. But to scientists' delight, faint traces of water seem to persist in the sunlit lunar surface. Instruments on three spacecraft confirmed the discovery, announced in 2009, but there was a catch. The analysis couldn't tell the difference between white water and hydroxyl. The researchers were looking for signatures of water on the lunar surface in infrared light. Similar to visible light split through a prism, infrared has its own rainbow, even though we can't see it, says Casey Honeyball, a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and leading author of the study on molecular water. These early analyses focused on a part of the infrared spectrum where both water and hydroxyl glow. By choosing a different section of the spectrum, Honeyball and her colleagues zeroed in on just the H2O, the water. Sunshine, who worked on the 2009 detections of water signals on the moon, says, "I honestly don't know why someone hadn't thought of it sooner. It's a brilliant idea." For a new study, Casey Honeyball and her colleagues collected data during a 2018 flight under Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, or SOFIA, an infrared telescope mounted on a jumbo jet. A couple of months later, Casey Honeyball was processing the data from the comfort of her couch when the water signal appeared. "I think I screamed," she says. Whilst present, the water is likely scarce, roughly equivalent to 12 ounces in a cubic meter of dirt. That's 100 times drier than the Sahara Desert. Honeyball notes, though she cautions that more work is needed to verify the concentrations of water, since the estimate is based on one observation at one location and at one time in the lunar day. The second study focused on the shadowy crevices on the lunar surface. Scientists have long suspected that water could linger as ice within massive craters in permanently shaded areas of the moon. The presence of ice in such spots was confirmed in October of 2009, when NASA crashed part of the L-Cross spacecraft into a shadowed area near the moon's south pole and detected evidence of ice in the impact plume. Researchers have since mapped these large frosty regions, but after looking at high-resolution images of the moon's surface from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the new study team realized that shady icy zones could be more common than thought, occurring even in very small areas. Every time they zoomed in on the images, they kept seeing more. "It's shadows all the way down," says Paul Hain, apparently scientist at the University of Colorado at Boulder and the leading author of the Shadow Zone study. By modeling temperatures and shadows on the moon, the team found that ice could form in tiny areas as small as an ant. These minute shadows can be just as cold as their bigger counterparts. Paul Haynes notes, "The moon's atmosphere is so thin it doesn't equalize surface temperature, so a boiling hotspot can be next to an area that is hundreds of degrees below zero." The new research suggests the area covered by cold, shadowy zones is about 20% greater than previously estimated. If all these zones are full of frost, the amount of ice would equate to billions of kilograms of water, according to Paul Hain. But how many actually have ice is still an open question. Together, the studies could help scientists start to piece together how the lunar water cycle works. Water on the moon comes from a few different sources. Some might arrive with meteorites that collide with the lunar surface, but some also likely forms when hydrogen from the solar wind reacts with surface oxygen to form hydroxyl. Heat from the sun and micrometeorite impacts could cause hydroxyl molecules to collide to form H2O, water. The heat from impactors such as micrometeorites could also melt some of the rocky surface and vaporize any water nearby. As the melt cools to glass, it could encapsulate the water vapor, and that may account for the watery signal Casey Honeyball and her team spotted. But exactly how and where water moves around on the surface remains unknown. Meteorites could liberate some water from the lunar surface, and the sun could also play a role in moving the water around, since the signal for water and hydroxyl weakens as the heat peaks in the lunar day. According to Casey Sunshine, Sunshine says, "Do we really lose it, or does it go to some shadowy zone?" she wonders. These small-scale cold taps could help us understand the water cycle. Scientists still have much to learn about lunar water, but some answers may be on the way. In 2022, NASA plans to send the Volatile Investigation Polar Exploration Rover, or VIPER, to the moon's south pole to search for water ice. Further clues should come from the Lunar Compact Infrared Imaging System, LCISRIS, also slated for a 2022 mission, according to Paul Hain. Scientists have speculated about the presence of water on the moon since at least the 1960s, but in the coming years, we should finally develop a full picture of where lunar water is hidden and whether we could use it to aid future explorers to the moon.
Food for thought.
Here are words worth pondering upon regarding the excellent husband and wife pair, the Prophet's daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, and Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, made, and which serve as model for all virtuous couples till this day, as related by Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him. Fatima vouched to take care of the household work, make dough, bake bread, and clean the house. In return, Ali vouched to take care of the outside work, such as procuring firewood and bringing food.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام ثلاث لا يزيد الله بهن المرأة المسلم إلا عزا: الصفح عمن ظلمه، وإعطاء من حرمه، والصلة لمن قطعه.
Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam stated, "There are three things through which Allah only increases the Muslim in honor: his pardon of one who has wronged him, his giving one who has deprived him, and his reconciliation with one who has cut him off."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the historical text that there is a very special conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, just to put this conversation into context, Jabir al-Jufi is no ordinary companion. He is one of the faithful companions of Imam al-Baqir, and he also happens to be one of the most knowledgeable students and faithful students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. So this individual is greatly esteemed and has a high status in Islam. And on the other hand, we have Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, of course, who is the divinely appointed imam, endowed with divinely appointed knowledge. In this conversation between the two, we find that at one point Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir, "There is no hope like the helping hope." Now, just to explain this a little bit, there is no hope better than, no aspiration better than, no yearning better than, no positive desire better than the positive desire, the aspiration, the yearning, and the hope which helps. And so the hope which helps us to do what, dear friends? The hope which helps us to become better human beings, the hope which helps us to become righteous servants of Allah, the hope which helps us to become perfect human beings, the hope which helps us to help humanity, to serve humanity, to work for the cause of peace and justice, the hope which helps us to serve the cause of humanity. And truly, the best hope, the hope which helps us to get closer to Allah. And so surely it makes sense, and it is true, now that we reflect a little bit upon this statement of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, that there is no hope better than the hope which helps. And as we said, the hope which helps us to get closer to our Creator, Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted, glorified be He. Beautiful, spiritual, profound words found towards the end of this conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
When you look at the date of the birth of Imam, first of Rajab, in the year 57 AH, this tells us that Imam al-Baqir is known as Tabi'i. In the descriptions of Muslims who are at the time of the Holy Prophet, as we know, they are known as Sahaba, companions of Rasulullah. The generation which came after the Sahaba are known as Tabi'in. Imam al-Baqir is known as Tabi' because he was born 46 years after the death of the Holy Prophet. If you look at the death of the Holy Prophet was 11 AH, he was born 57, so around 46 years. And he was born 40 years. Imam Amir al-Mumin died in the year 40 AH. So Imam al-Baqir was born 17 years after the death of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Imam Hassan died in the year 50, and Imam al-Baqir was born in 57. So Imam Hassan was not there. But at the time of Imam Hussein, Imam al-Baqir was born, and Karbala happened in the year 61. Imam was born on the 57 AH, so he was at least 3 or 4 years of age in Karbala. When you look at that, and then you imagine a young boy of 3 or 4 years of age in Karbala, you can see that that left a big mark in his life. Because for him to be there to see the massacre in Karbala, it was not easy.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
In the past few years, the United Arab Emirates has been seeking to increase its influence on Lebanese politics and society. Decades ago, the Emiratis launched their Lebanon project by running charities. Today, they're pulling the strings at the highest socio-political levels in the country. In late June, Arabic Post wrote that the UAE security apparatus has been playing a leading role in stirring up recent violence and riots in Lebanon. Quoting from the Lebanese Interior Minister Mohamed Fahmy through an unnamed source, the news outlet continued, "Friendly countries are generous to us, but to be honest, they're suffocating us." Fahmy didn't explicitly mention the country he accused of fomenting sedition, but private sources confirmed to Arabic Post that the accusations were all leveled against Abu Dhabi.
Lebanon is historically a very important location of the world. It's the midpoint region between the East and the West. It has a lot of resources. And plus, it is a very key player on the political, geographical level. So any country, actually, will want to consider having a part in Lebanon, especially if that country is also playing on a large scale with other countries. So I guess that they will consider that Lebanon is a court where they can score different goals over each other.
Meanwhile, sources close to the Hezbollah resistance movement say that they have evidence that proves the Emirati's involvement in the Beirut events and reveals their support of anti-Hezbollah groups.
Abu Dhabi doesn't actually care a lot for politics, the more it cares for economy, and the more it cares for technological advancement, and the more it cares for its own good. And she knows that all of those things are related for saying no to this key component in Lebanon. So that's why they're very clear with themselves. They know what they're doing. So apparently, saying yes to Hezbollah means they're going to lose a lot on the international level. So why should they do that?
Competing with Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries, the UAE has been seeking to expand its presence in Lebanon, first under the cover of charitable activities after the end of the civil war in 1990. Then they supported the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, funded various Islamic societies, mosques, Muslim clerics, and founded medical clinics and schools.
Well, as an activist in human development, and I really love to work in workshops and human development and skills, they are doing a great job, Emirates, they are doing a great job concerning all of those activities. I would just advise them if they would just, you know, not use them for covering other political acts, because they are able to be in Lebanon and do a lot of acts, and we're able to exchange a lot of things with them on the cultural level if they don't have hidden agendas.
Moreover, following the widespread protests in the Arab world in 2011, Abu Dhabi made its decision to stop its financial support of Islamic societies for their close association with the Muslim Brotherhood and other political Islamic currents. According to Watan Serb, the UAE ambassador frequently visited the Grand Mufti of Lebanon and asked him to remove from their positions the clerics and judges affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood and those sympathetic to Arab revolutions, and not to allow them to run for positions in the Supreme Islamic Council or other administrative positions. Moreover, sources from Islamic Group say that a group of Emirati officers have been pressuring the Lebanese authorities to dissolve the group and close their institutions.
Well, actually, because the Muslim Brotherhood and the other parties, they have this ideological way of dealing with things. And I told you, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and you know, it's like, it's sometimes they call themselves like the jewel of the West in the East. So they adopted the Western methodologies, they adopted the Western way with all its bad and good aspects. I'm not saying everything is bad, but they adopted everything and they went into this way of living and this lifestyle. So, and this is completely against what some Islamic groups, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, calls for or deal with. There's a huge ideological difference. There's a huge ideological gap between Muslim Brotherhood and such groups and what the leaders at Dubai actually call for, what they aspire for, what they want. So it's very normal to see them not on the same page, and they don't agree on the same terms.
Meanwhile, the current UAE ambassador, Hamad al-Shamsi, has opened extensive communication channels with Lebanese Christian personalities in several regions and provided unlimited support to Beirut Governor Ziad Shabib to help him with his projects, such as the renovation of churches and other Christian facilities in Beirut. The Emiratis have also worked hard to hire Lebanese media outlets to their own benefit by having them promote the role of the UAE in the country. News outlets such as Nida al-Watan are now clearly at the UAE's service in its competition with even the Saudi Kingdom and its adversity with Turkey, which is experiencing a growing popularity in the Western Asian country. By some credible sources, it was Abu Dhabi that foiled in 2017 the Saudi coup attempt against former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri when the Saudis detained him in Riyadh and forced him to resign. Watan News website has recently revealed the UAE Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed refused his country's participation in the coup plan against Hariri and informed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of this. A few days after Hariri's mysterious resignation, bin Zayed received Hariri in his palace. The move can be interpreted as a bid to undermine Saudi influence in Lebanon, which is now at a low ebb.
At that incident, Saudi Arabia was practicing a huge, vivid form of authority over the first political Sunni position in the Lebanese government, which is the prime minister. So Dubai would be crazy if she went with Saudi Arabia at that point. Dubai would never actually give such open space for Saudi Arabia to play in Lebanon. We said that there's this huge challenge between all the power figures of the world, power countries of the world. So it would be normal for Dubai to say no to that action. That doesn't mean that caring for Lebanon or the prime minister at that time. It means that this is simply against Dubai's best interests in the region.
In 2018, Saad al-Hariri, who was the leader of the Future Movement, promised the Islamic group that they could be part of his alliance in the upcoming parliamentary elections. However, shortly after, Hariri backtracked on his promise and cut off his relations with them. Sources close to the Islamic group say Hariri made the decision under pressure from Abu Dhabi, that's at loggerheads with the group. After the resignation of Saad al-Hariri in January this year, now there are rumors that the Emiratis are helping his brother rise and return to the country's political arena, just to make sure that they will maintain the equilibrium in Lebanon.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
According to figures from Human Rights Observers, a non-profit that monitors police evictions in northern France, there were 973 evictions in Calais in 2020, nearly three a day, and more than double the 452 recorded in 2018. In December alone, 526 tents were seized and 41 arrests were made. Isabella Anderson, a Human Rights Observer field coordinator, said, "It's been like this for months," she added. "These constant evictions are part of a policy by the French government to wear down asylum seekers, to fatigue them and take away their hope. It's like torture." We'll prepare for you an article written by Peter Young. The piece is titled, "Like Torture, French Police Accused of Continued Migrant Rights Abuses." The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Peter Young's article. Shortly before sunrise on 9th of January, about 40 officers and officials gathered outside the police station in Calais in northern France as temperatures dipped to minus 3 degrees Celsius. Shortly after, in a well-drilled procedure, a nine-vehicle convoy started down the road towards the first of five forced evictions of makeshift refugee camps planned for that morning. When the convoy arrived at the camp just a few miles from the city center, masked police officers in black uniforms chased refugees away from their tents and belongings. Some of the other 150 refugees who had been sheltering at the camp had already packed and fled before authorities arrived. Soon the camp was empty. Frost covers, sleeping bags, and jackets were all that remained. According to figures from Human Rights Observers, a non-profit that monitors police evictions in northern France, there were 973 evictions in Calais in 2020, nearly three a day, and more than double the 452 recorded in 2018. In December alone, for example, 526 tents were seized and 41 arrests were made. Isabella Anderson, a Human Rights Observer's field coordinator, said, "It's been like this for months," she added. "The constant evictions are part of a policy by the French government to wear down asylum seekers, to fatigue them and take away their hope. It's like torture." Although at several eviction sites, The Guardian was blocked by a perimeter of police, video evidence and first-hand documents showed what campaigners claimed are persistent human rights violations during police operations in